wants to warm up. Let's warm up.
Hello and welcome to Liberty Southwest podcast number 41. The date is January 21st, 2015. This week we're going to be talking about the trial of Ross Ulbricht, who is accused of being Dread Pirate Roberts, who is allegedly behind the website Silk Road, which was launched in 2011 and shuttered in 2013. Silk Road, an anonymous Bitcoin-enabled marketplace, was known as the Amazon or eBay of the darknet. I am joined today by Eric Taylor, Chelsea Como, Kirk Pettis, Danny Ning, and of course I am Matt Winterer. Eric, take it away.
Sure, so there's been a trial that's been going on now for about a month, having to do with a trial against Ulbricht, and he started the Silk Road in 2011. He allegedly started in 2011, I should say. This is a website.
It's been admitted he started it.
What's that?
It has been admitted he started it.
Right. So this site started in 2011. It exists on Tor, or what's known as the Onion Router, which is a network that anonymizes traffic and has been funded in part by the U.S. government, Navy, and armed forces. So it's probably not the best tool to use to anonymize yourself, which I think he's starting to understand.
Listeners, please do not use that.
Use what?
Tor.
Yeah, I know it's kind of funny. I mean, a few years ago, really, when you heard Tor, most people who were aware of it, they thought it was a good anonymization tool, right?
I think most everybody was willing to say that was going to be a relatively secure way. I don't think most people understood the widespread amount of surveillance that the U.S. has on endpoints. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it was the purpose of Tor was to allow for anonymous communication for U.S. intelligence officers and military personnel domestic and foreign. So they opened up, allegedly opened up Tor to everyone. They wanted to invite people onto the Tor network in the guise that this was a complete anonymizing type of solution. And really the goal, or the alleged goal, was an anonymity through numbers. So the more people that use the network, the more hidden or anonymous the real actors behind the project became. And that was, and they didn't care if, allegedly didn't care if there was illicit activity, as long as their communication wasn't easily picked up by outside actors. So that's kind of what drew in libertarians, anarchists, people who set up the Silk Road for, the Silk Road essentially ended up being primarily used for, illicit activities, drug trafficking, human trafficking, gun sales, other black and gray market activities, which is what the U.S. government is really going after Ulbricht for.
Now, something that I think is interesting is I hear a lot of people, when they first start hearing about Bitcoin, talk about how they hear that it's used for illicit transactions. Whether it's drug sales or, trafficking. And the thing that boggles me more than anything else is the fact that if we really sit down and think about what type of currency is, has historically been used for the greatest number of illegal activities, I mean, what first comes to mind for you guys? I mean, would you say that Bitcoin is the biggest perpetrator, or the, you know, the currency that most allows illicit transactions to occur? Or would you say that the cold hard cash, the dollar, has been used and maybe its fair share of illegal activities?
I would say that you've got a substantially higher amount of criminal activity taking place using cash.
Exactly. So how does, you know, how is Bitcoin, you know, somehow being demonized because some people chose to use it for illicit, you know, transactions? I mean, couldn't we say the same for every single currency that's ever existed?
I'm going to
interrupt you real quick here. I'm going to add Blake Anderson to the call as well, or to the podcast. He has quite a bit to, you know, he's involved quite a bit with Bitcoin. So I'm sure.
You want to just start that RT clip and then bring him in?
I'm going to add him to the call right now. All right. He should be joining shortly. Sorry, go ahead. Continue, Chelsea. Sorry to interrupt.
No, I think that's the just the biggest piece of it, because I feel like there was this huge, you know, sort of campaign against Bitcoin under the premise that it allowed for illicit transactions. But people somehow failed to miss the fact that all currency has been used for illicit transactions, and the dollar, by, you know, a long shot, has exceeded the total, you know, amount of transactions in terms of illegal activities than Bitcoin has. So why would this even be brought up in terms of like a downside to Bitcoin when it's just a downside of money that people will find a way, you know, to create illicit transactions?
Maybe it's just a precursor to getting rid of any kind of cash transaction whatsoever that's not controlled through electronic means.
Or it's a threat. It's a threat to, you know, national currencies as well, the fiat currencies.
That is definitely the reason, but I think it's why people just assume Bitcoin is an illegal transaction is just because they don't know about it and they don't utilize it. Uses Bitcoin, they're not going to think it's for illicit activity. So I think it's just how your brain works. It searches for answers and easily pins it into something that is so easily PR'd against because of it's a hamper against national currencies of the world.
By the way, let's welcome Blake Anderson to the podcast. Welcome, Blake.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much. Sorry for being late here.
No problem at all.
No problem.
Are you guys touched on that as well, Blake?
I've just been recording all the illegal stuff that Bitcoin's used for, you know, trying to help out with the, you know, really, really awesome and moral actors that use the dollar, which never gets used for anything illegal. So I've been real, real wrapped up doing that. No, it's been good. It's been a lot of news. The price is kind of at a pullback right now. So that's when a lot of development happens. So there's a firestorm of people generating ideas, and a lot of people come to me with their ideas, and it's taken over my sleep. So it's been hectic. How about yourselves?
It's been good. It's good to have our one and only guest on for the second time.
Thank you very much, man. It's cool to contact some more local people. I do so much stuff with people that are far away that it's you know, cool to get back to talking to people that I could maybe, you know, go have lunch with or meet with or you know, work on a business endeavor up here. So it's a different beast, and I enjoy it.
Definitely, definitely.
One thing that really struck me about this case is that I was under the impression that Bitcoin allowed for anonymous transactions, and we're starting to see people being pinned to their wallets and finding out that there's less anonymity than we originally understood to be the case. So then that sort of leads me down the trail of saying, okay, what else did we originally believe about Bitcoin, and can we assume that all of those other things are true?
Yeah, that's definitely a good point. I mean, there's the differentiation that a lot of people make in the tech parlance of, you know, fancy word spinning, and they say it's pseudo-anonymous. Bitcoin is pseudo-anonymous. So you'll hear people saying pseudo-anonymous all the time. It's like, well, what does pseudo-anonymous mean? Does that mean like fake or faux anonymous or not anonymous? And what it means is pseudonym anonymous. You're using a name or an identifier that's constant, but it's not you, and so you're not tied to it. But you can take steps to make it so that you are tied to it with your action. So anonymity is actually, there's a gradient of how anonymous things are or not because of, it gets kind of complicated. There's technical, practical impossibility, and then there's, you know, is it practically impossible or is it literally impossible? And it's never literally impossible for people to get access to your stuff. That's just kind of the way that the things work. But you can make it practically impossible, make it impractical by behaving in certain ways. So that being the case, the way that you behave and conduct yourself online and with business and with your wallet is going to have a big impact on how anonymous or not your financial information is relative to Bitcoin. And that's a kind of a long and boring topic. So unfortunately, some people will say things like, it's super anonymous, which, you know, can be true, but it requires a lot more explanation than to just deliver that, you know, bomb to somebody. Hey, it's super anonymous, then have them go and expect that that's the case. And I think that you're right, that's something that that people should really be aware of that the anonymity is only as good as is the way that you're using it.
And that's what we've seen with the Ross Ulbricht trial as well. That seems to be what the prosecution is really hinging their case on, right, is the fact that they have identified the wallet and have said that, you know, he's amassed most of his or a portion of his wealth through transactions on the Silk Road rather than speculating on Bitcoin. Isn't that kind of how it's working right now?
Yeah, I believe that the prosecution stated that something like 20% of various different funds and his addresses were associated with accounts on the Silk Road. So that's, you know, it's pretty much incontrovertible evidence of various different interactions there. But there's also the defense that there's been multiple DPRs and we don't know who's who, and Karpalis was actually fingered by the investigation before this started. So there's some stuff up in the air. They're really hoping for that to be able to be brought up. Again, they brought up the Karpalis defense saying that the people that were working on this case identified some of his traffic information as having to do with what went on at the Silk Road. And Mark Karpalis, if you guys don't recall his name right away, is the
Mt. Gox.
The Mt. Gox mastermind, for lack of a better word there. So the case is not looking fantastically well in that it's already a federal case and there's already a precedent of, you know, harsh punishments for conspiratorial drug ring and mafia stuff. But I think that he ran a great website, and that if they're going to prosecute him, they should have to, you know, do something about Craigslist and stuff too. But of course, I don't want them to go after Craigslist. I just want them to leave Ross alone. But it's been pretty brutal so far.
Yeah, and speaking of the Mt. Gox guy, I think the defense is actually going to bring a third person up too that could have been another DPR at times.
Could you guys fill out what DPR stands for the listeners that don't know?
Yeah.
So as you referenced earlier. Yeah. So like the online name or the, you know, what do you call it? Is it pseudonym? Is that an appropriate term for this?
Yep. That would
handle moniker.
Yeah. Yeah. So was Dread Pirate Roberts. And for all of you people listening who have seen The Princess Bride, it's a throwback to that. And I don't know if, you know, so what makes sense here, if you think about the character, Dread Pirate Roberts, in context of The Princess Bride, it wasn't one person. It was someone who started out as a pirate, then passed that name and all of his reputation along to the next pirate that followed after him, and on and on. So the idea here is that the pseudonym could have been passed from one person to another, and it would make sense considering, you know, the name and the context and the reference.
Yeah, so, exactly. It's important to remember that everything that this specific pseudonym represents is more than one, multifaceted, decentralized, disorganized. You can't go and be like, this one person founded it, and then there's the name and birthdays and stuff. Like, that's the point of the DPR pseudonym, is that it's passed down, that it's, you know, unkillable.
Yeah, and when Ross developed Silk Road, I mean, DPR didn't come on for, I don't know how long. It wasn't like Ross started the website and came on and he was DPR right away. It was, you know, what I like about Ross is that he's very libertarian. He's follows a lot of the Mises Institute, and he started the website as a pure founded on libertarian free market economics, to where it's just a pure no regulations website, and over time it got taken over by the drug trade and various other means, but predominantly it was used for drug trade mechanism. And so it's, you know, it wasn't set up that way, but it was also an economic experiment that was working quite well.
Well, exactly. And it's an economic experiment which is supposed to be the cornerstone of both political parties in this country. The defense of free markets, the staunch defense of free markets, is the cornerstone of conservative and liberal politics in this country. So really, why does anybody have a problem with the fact that he made a truly free market? That's troubling, I think.
Because it's the pseudonym of the government to pretend about the free market.
Yeah, the government's up to all kinds of stuff too. Yeah, definitely.
Well, and as you referenced with Craigslist, I mean, we've seen many instances in which there was, you know, prostitution or other illegal activities that were conducted via Craigslist.
Yeah, there's been more marijuana sold on Craigslist than was ever sold on the Silk Road.
So why are we seeing an attack specifically of the Silk Road as opposed to something like Craigslist?
Because of what Ross started it as. He started it as a direct jab against the government, as, you know, a pure free market institution. And that, to me, that's why he challenged the system versus Craigslist. Craigslist doesn't go out there and state, you know, we're challenging the system, you know, we're putting it out there. They don't have that philosophy basis behind it. But,
well, and Craigslist is still founded in dollars, you know, primarily, I would assume. Are the foundation of most of those transactions, as opposed to something like Bitcoin, which challenges the dollar and the Federal Reserve and the current powers, very powerful powers that be.
Yeah, I mean, the Silk Road was like, if, you know, the government's really big and really tough, they've got their aircraft carriers and stuff, but the Silk Road was a black widow spider, and the government was like, oh, that's not good.
Better watch out. And now there's...
You could say the same about Bitcoin as well. So you have two methodologies that are intertwined, that are kind of, you know, it's an easy target to make an example of as well, right?
Oh, definitely, definitely. But the spider, they can smash it. I mean, Bitcoin is like the mirror in the Matrix. When Neo touches it, it consumes his whole body, and like you can't do anything with it. Like, it's an anti-fragile system. The anti-fragility of Bitcoin is like really bizarre. It makes it hard to compare it to things and then not listen to yourself later and be like, no, that was bad.
Yeah. And, well, do we want to do a clip about an overview, or should we just keep going about it?
I'd like to hear it.
Research.
I'd like to hear it.
Yeah, sure. So I have this is about 8 minutes long, and we can stop through. So just let me know. This is RT clip. Ben Swan gives an overview of the trial and how it's gone. It's about a week old now, but it's a pretty good overview and can add more to the conversation.
Swanny boy's the man.
One of the important trials in the nation is underway in New York, and yet not one word from corporate media. The trial of alleged founder of the website The Silk Road, Ross Ulbricht, is now underway. Now, The Silk Road, you might remember, it's a site that was a major Bitcoin playground where users allegedly made all kinds of illegal transactions, including it becoming a major drug marketplace. But this story is a lot bigger than just Ulbricht and The Silk Road. RT correspondent Alexei Yaroshevsky reports from New York.
A trial which potentially could have very far-reaching implications has just started in New York City, although without much coverage and fanfare. Now, the accused is 29-year-old Ross Ulbricht, the man...
That's a good point. And I've heard this several times from various interests that have been covering this, but you really don't hear a lot about this trial on, you know, major news outlets like CNN or CNBC or, you know, in any of the newspapers, which has been, you know, somewhat interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very dangerous idea. If it was really had a lot of coverage and stuff, I think that your average person would be like, you could buy drugs safely and securely on this website, and they shut it down, but, like, the technology to do it again still exists. Let's help work on this. Like, that could be a disaster for their strong-arming monopoly on the drug trade.
That's true. No doubt. I'll continue.
That the federal government believes ran the notoriously known website Silk Road from 2011 to 2013. It has not yet been proved that Ross Ulbricht, in fact, ran this website. But the website was shut down in 2013 for selling drugs. In fact, it was described as the Amazon or eBay of the darknet, anonymously selling narcotics online to almost 900,000 users and generating profits of about $1 billion annually. But as The Wired reported, during the pretrial hearings, the prosecution all but admitted that the FBI hacked the Silk Road website without a warrant. There's also a lot of questions about the extent of NSA's involvement in this.
Is that true? I hadn't heard that the website had actually been hacked by the FBI.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that either.
I would more accurately say that the description of all evidence presented by the defense was that the collection of said evidence violated the Fourth Amendment. So some people draw from that that they must have hacked the server, but there's other ways for that to have happened as well.
Well, and that's definitely an interesting point. Part about the trial is that the facts haven't been released yet, how they got this, and obviously I don't think they want to show how the means of accumulating the knowledge. But
I thought they said that they went into his house and he didn't shut down his computer in time. Did they not have a warrant when they went after him?
No, this is what's at the start of the trial, how the trial began.
Yeah, this would have been pre-warrant.
Yeah, and they got a hold of the server. They mirrored this, and then they ended up giving evidence. They were blackmailing DPR, whoever that is, and saying that we're going to release all this information because they mirrored the server, and they had all the knowledge about everyone that was doing business on there, and they were leaking information to them, trying and blackmail them, saying they need $500,000 cash. And that's what led to the supposed death threats against that person trying to blackmail DPR. And both people ended up being the undercover federal officer or multiple people. So the government came in as a pseudonym and got it. They got the information. They tried to blackmail him as a screen name.
And then another officer came in
and pretended to be the
problem. And then it was all set up all along, and it's just despicable. And, of course, Ross was like, no. Ross was interacting with the first person because they knew as a result of his character and libertarianism and his love for his fellow man that he would try to protect the other users. So they used literally his own goodness against him to get him to be involved enough with these other officers that he talked to them enough to, get entangled by people that are expertly trained in saying certain things and doing certain things to get you to reveal information that they need.
Yeah, we've seen it by many FBI cases that are in the terrorism aspect all the time of setting people up and that would never do such things, and they give them the means, the money, and all of a sudden they find themselves in front page news and by making poor decisions. And it's still not clarified if it was exactly Ross that were making these murder accusations or anything, too, because the government was setting this up from the get-go. If they're willing to go to those ends, why not even pretend they're DPR at times, too?
There's also been a lot of
as evidence.
Yeah, and there's also been a lot of reports, too, that a lot of the inside actors, like there were government agents involved in the first iteration of Silk Road. And then the second one, when it sprang up, it was all basically, allegedly, according to internet rumors, started by those same bad actors that were trying to get state powers to shut down the market. They started another one. So that's fairly disconcerting as well.
Oh. I'll continue rolling here.
Case and whether the FBI actually used information obtained from the NSA. Ross Ulbricht is facing life in prison on different accusations, on different charges, ranging from money laundering, drug trafficking, and different other serious charges. All of them he is denying. He says he is not guilty. But the outcome of this trial is very important, as many people online have described, because this could have implications for the future of internet security, because if Ross Ulbricht gets a serious prison sentence, this would potentially mean that the authorities have the rights to file charges and make their cases against pretty much every online user.
Which we've I think this was actually outlined in the State of the Union last night. It's been kind of a topic over the last week. You hear cybersecurity pop up. I haven't heard the topic.
But did you hear Obama and Cameron were like, there shouldn't be any encryption that we can't read? And as an information scientist that specializes in computer security, that's like face-meltingly, horrifyingly. That's like when, who was it? Was it Palin that said she wanted to like make all porn illegal? Like the most untenable plan that you could possibly make and waste money on.
Yeah, to me, you know, there's that meme out there that the number one gun salesman is Barack Obama.
Yeah.
The next meme, I think, is thanks, Barack Obama. He's making the most libertarians out there than anyone else previously.
And Hillary 2016, bring it down faster.
I think one of the things that they said is we don't need backdoors anymore. We need front doors to communication.
And it's just like,
is that an innuendo?
Only if you want it to be, Matt.
Only if you want it. Yeah.
Well, coming from the government, they're going to get you one way or another.
Yep.
All right, I'll continue here.
Well, joining me now to go in depth on this story is investigative journalist Derek Brose, who was covering the trial for BenSwan.com. And Derek, it's good to have you here with us. Let's talk a little bit about there are some really bigger picture issues here. At least three things going on in this trial besides Ross Ulbricht. But you said there was something that broke right at the end of the trial today. Tell me about that.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ben. So at the end of today's proceedings, the defense, Ross Ulbricht's defense, was cross-examining the government's star witness, which is a DHS agent, Department of Homeland Security agent, who's been following the Silk Road and trying to track down Dread Pirate Roberts for the past couple years. And in that cross-examination, Ross's defense brought up the fact that this same agent was also, merely months before arresting Ross as supposedly being Dread Pirate Roberts, the head of Silk Road, they were also tracking another well-known Bitcoin persona, Mark Karpeles, who was involved with the MT Gox that was shut down last year.
One of the things that I've read is that there's one, you know, an internet rumor that's been floating around is that potentially there might have been some way that the Mt. Gox founder was trying to frame Ulbricht. Have you guys heard anything about that?
Yeah, it's entirely possible. Have you seen the Kaiser Sose meme of Mark Karpeles?
I have not.
Well, the is it okay to like have spoilers of like a 30-year-old movie?
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. We spoiler new movies.
Okay, cool. So Kaiser Sose was this extremely terrifying character in this movie called The Usual Suspects. And the entire movie, he acted like he didn't know what was going on. He was scared, and he like was, you know, almost like halfway kind of crippled and had a limp and had a stutter. And, you know, a really big crime had been committed. But everyone's like, no, this person's too stupid. It couldn't be him. And then Kaiser Sose at the very, very end of the movie when they're going to throw the wrong person in jail is Kevin Spacey, and he's walking down the street and he's, you know, holding his bum arm and he's shuffling down. And you feel sad and sorry for him. And then he starts to walk a little bit more appropriately, and then he corrects his back and he starts full striding and whips out a lighter and lights a cigarette and gets into a limo. And it's just like, oh, man, he pulled the wool over everyone. So the meme, the Kaiser Sose, Mark Karpeles, Silk Road framing meme is everybody thought that it was incompetence that brought down Mt. Gox, but apparently he was some kind of super genius, like stealing shit and embezzling money and framing other people for totally separate giant criminal organizations. So that's where the Karpeles Sose meme comes from. And it'll be interesting to see where all that leads, because right now it's just beyond bizarre, in my opinion.
Right. So that's an angle that, you know, is within the realm of possibility, but hasn't been mentioned too much.
If you look at those the typage of when the murder for hire accusations are, it sounds much more that character than ever Ross Ulbricht. I mean, if you go and study about Ross and what he's all libertarian, the non aggression principle, there's just no way that it sounds like him and by any means. And when you learn about Karpeles, I've never said his name before, so I'm totally going to
– he's not American, so we all get a pass.
Yeah. I mean, that guy just thinks he's Dr. Evil. It's what I've always heard about the guy, but
Yeah, Chris Ellis was ripping on him today, being like, he's done all this stuff, and he's still out there just tweeting. And he's tweeting pictures of cats, and it pisses me off.
Bald cats.
Okay. Yeah, so I mean, that's something that seems to be, you know, a strong possibility. It wouldn't surprise me at all. I'll continue here.
You're in a big disgrace. That same agent in a sworn affidavit said that they were following Mark, and he believed that he had the knowledge, the capability, the technology, and the network to also be Dread Pirate Roberts. And at that point, the government stepped forward and started objecting to bringing that in there, and they tried to say that now, you know, this witness's statements were irrelevant, and so the judge ended up dismissing the jurors a little bit early today so they could go back and forth and discuss whether they were going to allow that information to come into the case. So that was.
And that's interesting how the judge was so dismissive of.
Yeah. Shuttle all the jurors out. Let's talk about this in private because it could be really damaging to our attempt to just lock this person away for information that violates the Fourth Amendment in the way that we collected it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's dubious at best.
Well, and what's crazy is they arrested him on charges of murder or hiring for murder, and he's not being charged with any of that now. And that's what had him, he couldn't get out of jail, no bail. The prosecutor's able to leak that into the jury just to, you know, put that in people's mindsets of this whole, this website was used to as hitmen, you know, you could contact hitmen on there when I firmly believe every hitman was a government employee.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, how many normal people do you know that are, like, going around being like, hey, I'm going to offer my assassination services over the internet stuff, man. Like, this is going to be awesome. Like,
not only that, but have the knowledge to be able to find something like the Silk Road and then, you know, get onto Tor. Yeah,
I'm not using this for drugs. I'm using this for, like, my assassination business. I know it's exactly. I'm using it for drugs, but somebody here's got to need an assassin. Eventually, I'm going to find
Man, I played a video game. I played a video game. That's how this shit works.
Oh man!
Hitman wanting or not being aware of the fact that Tor is about as insecure as you can possibly
use
to do something like that, and you're not going to like be using Tor with like all the like your Java applets coming in and like around your face, like you know what I mean? Like there's, I don't know, if you're a hitman smart enough to go and find where people would even need your services and charge a lot and stuff, but then not smart enough to not use Tor. And it's the whole thing is just like, no, it's clearly it's somebody that doesn't care about getting caught or not because they're an agent and they're not going to be held responsible for anything.
Yep.
Yeah, it just rings a bell of setup completely, in my opinion.
Right. Absolutely.
It was really a big piece of information, which backs up what Ross Ulbricht's defense has been trying to say since the beginning of this trial on Tuesday, which is essentially that they admitted Ross did start the Silk Road, but at some point things started to get a little too hectic for him, get out of control, and he backed up and handed it over to other people. And at that point, this Dread Pirate Roberts name started to come into existence. And the theory is that it's a name that has been passed among several people or groups of people. And Ross's team said after that happened, once the people who were behind the Dread Pirate Roberts name realized they were being tracked by the federal government and that there was a bust coming soon, they somehow, and we have yet to see this, but they somehow lured Ross back into being involved and left him holding the bag.
Which could have been potentially a setup. And that kind of.
Yeah, it sounds extremely likely, especially given the fact that they had other provocateurs trying to sell and do hits and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's even possible that those people that, you know, that those weren't people that were going to take the fall. Those were probably agents.
Very likely.
Well, the
Very
one possible. Here's the piece that I don't understand, and maybe you guys know more about this. So as, if you start up a website that allows for, you know, transactions to occur, whether it's a Craigslist type situation or eBay, how involved are you in the actual day-to-day transactions? And then, you know, the second question being why or how would you be culpable for the transactions that are occurring on your website?
Well, I mean, in the case of the Silk Road, because it was a, pseudo-anonymous hidden marketplace and stuff, there was a role for an administrator for a long time to go through and see who had bad reputation scores and stuff like that, like who wasn't paying or who was doing bad stuff and then trying to get bad actors out of it. So there would have been a pretty intense weeding process, and there would probably have been several people working on trying to make the site operable with self-imposed regulations set forth by people that really wanted it to succeed. So, yeah, I mean, I think that there's probably a lot of involvement by several people, but it sounds like it's possible that the government did a lot of that, which is just bizarre.
And Albrecht may not have been really involved. You know, he set up the site, but the subsequent Dread Pirate Roberts actors very well could have been the individuals that administered and facilitated that type of activity.
Exactly. The workload that comes along with the infrastructure that was provided by Ross had to be used by somebody, the DPR, to make an operable marketplace that brought people in and that kicked people out that were, you know, not doing things that they approved of.
Yeah, and that's the basis. That's why this trial has so much ramifications, because they're pinning him as this big drug kingpin, you know. But in my opinion, a drug kingpin pays his employees, you know, the dealers or whatever out there, and, you know, he wouldn't have to have his hands dirty. And then they put that whole murder for hire stuff in there to paint the image that's always in the back of people's minds. Instantly, all right, oh, he is a drug kingpin then, you know, he's taking out his competition or people he doesn't like, the threatening. And it doesn't, but the basis is, yeah, he just started a website and as an experiment and let it go on. And, you know, they have their own ethics or regulations to weed out bad players in it. And that's, you know, so that's, this doesn't fit. Maybe that's the new 22nd version of a drug kingpin, but I disagree.
Yeah, I mean, it's so bizarre. And there's so many cases where they're just doing and saying such bizarre things. Like, there was jury nullification activists outside of the courthouse handing out papers, and the judge was like, well, there is risk here that this jury could be tainted. So if we don't get rid of all those people protesting and stuff, we're probably going to have to, like, sequester the jury and do a whole bunch of stuff that's going to make them super inconvenienced and uncomfortable and, like, want to go for a conviction right away and stuff, which is just, like, absurd. And to say that you're doing it because the jury might be tampered with, and the tampering you're talking about is hearing about the option of jury nullification, which is the truth and a fact. I mean, that's not tampering. That's just proof that Yeah, I mean, that's proof that they'll say what they need to say to you know, slant and spin things, when it's just there's nothing wrong with that going on. That's a constitutional freedom. Our country's based on it. It's our legal system. People need to know that nullification is an option. It's just absurd to call that jury tampering.
Yeah, and they're not going after those specific jurors. They're just outside the courtroom handing out information to anyone that's willing to accept it, or, you know, educate any passerbys if possible. And so it's not – you can't jury tamper by any means. But as a public facility, you have the right to do that. And it's been many different court cases. It's been allowed and disallowed at times, and it really reflects upon the judge a lot of times, or what city it relies in. Jurisdiction stuff, but
if you take out the fancy language, it's basically like, you better get rid of those people in front of the courthouse that I don't like, or I'll undermine the ability of this man to have a fair trial. So good luck, you guys. I'm a judge and do what I say. Otherwise, I'm going to make you pay because I have a government position where I can, you know, lord rule over people. And it's just, it's disgusting.
Yeah.
All right, I'll continue here.
As the defense has said, and that's what led to his arrest. But today
that's a pretty interesting point that you're saying, that the DHS agent involved wasn't sure who the Dread Pirate Roberts was and thought it could be several people. I want to go through a couple of other issues, though, because this trial, as we were saying, it's bigger than just Ross. Let's talk about Bitcoin, because a major part of this trial is the inference that this is a criminal cryptocurrency that was being used to provide cover for criminals. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, so we have a jury here, 16 different people who likely have never heard of Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, the Tor browser, or, you know, deep web, or any of these really new technologies. And the way the government is presenting this is essentially, at certain points, they've made it sound like not only that Ross was, like, the creator of Bitcoin or something, but that Bitcoin's only use is for criminal activity, you know, purchasing of illegal illicit drugs and fake IDs and hacking software and things like that. But thankfully today in the cross-examination, his team was able to inform the jury that, hey, Overstock.com accepts Bitcoin. You can pay for your rent. You can pay for universities and all kinds of things, and really got them to understand the value of Bitcoin as a tool. But you know, what we're seeing here is it's not just Ross Ulbricht on trial, although Ross is absolutely important to this, obviously, but we're seeing the deep web put on trial. We're seeing the Bitcoin technology, blockchain technology being put on trial. And this is huge because it's the first time in a federal court that these issues have ever been brought up. And
do you think that's true, Blake? Do you think this is, to a certain extent, this is Bitcoin also being, you know, brought to trial?
I mean, as a platitude, it can be said, but there's not really any heavy ramifications specifically for the protocol as a result of this trial. It's not really an economic trial. I mean, this trial is really for the soul and spirit of America and our defense of free markets, or our willingness to abandon them to regulatory capture and fiat debt crises and stuff forever. I mean, like, where are we going to draw the line in the sand? This is a big deal. But as far as specifically Bitcoin, I don't know that it's going to be able to have a lasting effect on Bitcoin.
I agree with that.
I mean, I could see it as just another PR attack, though, because, like, for the average person that doesn't know anything about Bitcoin, they start to hear these things and they associate it with illegal activities and things only criminals, you know, would need Bitcoin. It's only for drug transactions and bad things. And they just have these negative emotional connections to it as they're being exposed to it through things like this. And so to me, it's almost like a slanderous PR campaign, trying to just get people to associate Bitcoin with illegal transactions.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree. When TCP/IP technology came along and everything was the phone companies, and then, you know, we actually had, you know, packet sending and data that would go on you know, networks that could be different than frame encapsulation or whatever, there was all kinds of dirt. Like, every single person on the internet is a pedophile and a drug dealer user and a hacker, and they're dangerous and you shouldn't talk to them. And that same stuff is coming to smear Bitcoin, and Bitcoin's going to be more disruptive than the maybe not more disruptive than the internet, because that disrupted people's limited access to information and stuff, but it's going to be disruptive. So it'll be quite a sight.
Yeah, I'll continue here.
And, you know, whatever they decide at the end will definitely have some big implications for those technologies.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I want to talk to you about the dark web part of it as well, because as you said, most of the people sitting on this jury are not familiar with a lot of these terms. They don't know what the dark web is. It sounds very scary. It sounds like a dangerous place where only terrible things could happen. Is essentially the government attempting to create this picture that Bitcoin, the dark web, all of these issues are actually, they are the criminal part of this case. And this guy, as you said, is ultimately the perpetuator of all these terrible things.
That's what they seem to be alluding to. The defense has thankfully been clearing up some of that, but the government did their job for the first 2 days. Everything they were presenting was really tedious, and essentially they just had their undercover agent discuss how he did 50 to 60 undercover buys. He infiltrated the administration team of the Silk Road. He was using, you know, all kinds of different accounts, like we know that, you know, governments do. They have them come infiltrate and do intelligence operations like that, and they were showing that in their eyes, Bitcoin's only use is these illicit activities, and that Ross was, you know, as this role of Dread Pirate Roberts allegedly was promoting this and, you know, was allowing these things to continue. Because essentially the first 2 days, all the government did was just show pictures of drugs that they purchased on the Silk Road and, you know, pictures of all kinds of, like, crack, cocaine, and all these things. And really, we were sitting there asking ourselves, what does this have to do with Ross? There's no evidence that connects Ross Ulbricht to these crimes as well. And this what gets into the bigger picture as far as internet freedom goes, because
it ultimately will become a case, it looks like, that's guilt by association is what they're building. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We'll have to leave it there. But Derek Bros, investigative journalist, thanks so much for your time and covering the story.
Look, I'm sold. There's no way. They got pictures. I mean, dude, they got pictures of stuff, and they're showing pictures. It's so not.
Well, and that's what people need to realize, that Ross, if he was making any money from the website, it was from the administration side and charging a commission for every transaction that goes through, that funnels through the site. It's not through specific, you know, controlling drug trades. an offhand way, which is like Craigslist or, I mean, any eBay, Amazon, that's, they all do the same thing. And so that's where the ramifications are, can lead to other problems in the future for other companies as well.
Well, and I mean, I'm going to go, you know, take this just maybe two steps farther than where we might have already gone to say, if we're going to talk about markets, what is one of the most basic understandings we have about how markets work, right? Like, square one is supply and demand, right? We wouldn't have a drug trade if there weren't people out there demanding it, you know? And so I think maybe this is an opportunity to look to ourselves and say, why is there such a demand for drugs in this world? Why do people want them so much? I mean, why?
They're amazing.
You know, and then, you know, to take another step and say, I mean, we've waged a war on drugs. We see that it doesn't work. And the war on drugs didn't start with the Silk Road. I mean, this has been an issue for as long as I can remember. And, I mean, people have been seeking mind-altering substances for thousands of years. So, and using them for thousands of years. And no attempts, you know, by our government, you know, have deterred people from wanting or using drugs. And, you know, the fact that there was just yet another medium used in order to facilitate a transaction doesn't mean that Albrecht is a drug dealer or ruining the world. I mean, I think that that's a ridiculous way to frame things.
I completely agree. And I think that people do drugs because of the government. And I think that I can prove that people do drugs because of the government. Because what does the government do? The government comes in with force and all kinds of misery and sadness and just the human shit that we have to try to trudge through to get things done. And then when there's no solidarity anymore, because solidarity are the ties in society that bind us together in our, you know, collective struggle and our individual passions and fires and stuff like that. When you steal from people and give to other people, it creates resentment. And then there's class warfare and all kinds of shit and everybody's unhappy. So then everybody wants to escape and drink lots of alcohol or smoke other kinds of drugs and things like that. And, you know, occasional drug use I have no problem with. But I think that the habitual drug abuse problem in Russia and America is because solidarity has been so deeply damaged by the horror that is the state.
And the fact it's illegal. There's just the inner psyche that when things are illegal, it draws, you know, there's that wanderlust into it as well. But also,
well,
any
forbidden fruit thing.
Any controlling government needs patsies, and government throws out patsies as, you know, these people that do drugs and whatnot, and it's just thrown out there hypothetically and ignored that. Obviously, like Chelsea said, it's in high demand and it's an underground part of society that's highly prevalent. And it's, and not even to get into the fact that the CIA is heavily into the drug trade industry itself.
Yeah, they can fund independently because of the drug trade. Yeah, no, the CIA can fund independently because they have the ability to liquidate drugs as they see fit, which means that they don't have to answer to anybody. They become a shadow government in and of themselves. It's an extremely volatile and dangerous situation that's developed with the CIA.
Well, they've been doing that since the 1970s, though.
Yeah,
1980s.
Well, like with the poppy fields in Afghanistan, before we went and started really meddling over there, you know, in the more recent decades, the poppy fields were almost gone. And now they're flourishing like we've never seen before. And I wonder why that might be.
It's like, GMO poppies. Like, we got Monsanto over here.
our government specifically spent $4 billion into destroy the drug trade in Afghanistan. And now it's went from like 10 or 15% to 90% of the poppies in the world, heroin outfit. And we spent $4 billion to eradicate it.
Mm. No.
That's a good investment.
We need to be there to save our freedom.
Yes.
So what do you guys –
it all makes sense to me.
Getting back to the Albrecht trial, one of the things that I've also seen is the idea of parallel construction, specifically data gathering by intelligence agencies that aren't legal, that are, you know – potentially being utilized to bring up a case against Albrecht. Has anyone
meaning you have one ranch procuring information illegally, supplying it to someone else, and then helping them build the case?
Correct.
Yeah, like the reverse engineering. Yeah, I think that that happens constantly.
Well, and that's what the NSA has been highly accused of.
That's what they do,
right? They keep funneling out local government or local police forces and to, you know, hand them information, and then they say you cannot tie this into us, you know, make up whatever story you have to do to, you know, because this is illegal, unconstitutional, but
so a violation of forthright, the Fourth Amendment.
And gray area associated with electronic surveillance, right? I mean, so as the internet popped up, and our founding fathers couldn't have imagined this, the government, first and foremost, took the stance that, you know, the Fourth Amendment didn't apply to anything electronic. You know, so their original stance was, we can do whatever we want, we can search whatever we want on the internet without warrant, because, you know, that wasn't specifically outlined. You know, so the founding fathers, of course, only meant physical searches and seizures was their original stance. And so now we're starting to see people coming around to say, well, I don't know about that. I mean, intellectual property and my information is my property, and searches don't have to be physical to be searches that should require warrants. But the government tends to just, you know, fly in the face of that and say, nope, it wasn't specifically outlined. We're going to do whatever the hell we want to, regardless of what's right and what would have been intended by that.
Very good point.
You know, the founding fathers have known about the internet.
And I think that when you're talking about this trial or cybersecurity initiatives, or, you know, it's kind of a big topic right now. And it seems to me to be a concerted effort to erode the idea that the Fourth Amendment applies to digital communication.
It does seem like that's under attack. And I mean, I think that the only thing that they can do if they actually use the court systems for the amount of issues that would come up on the internet is they would have to give up the stupid bullshit uses for the court that have developed that were never supposed to be used for. So the courts are overloaded with a whole bunch of stuff that's victimless and all that kind of stuff. They don't have time to treat the internet in any way other than you're free for all. We don't have warrants for all this stuff. We're collecting data from everybody and, you know, it would be a nightmare. Our legal process says.
Nope. Hold on. Issue.
I'm holding on.
You back? Okay. We're good.
Dropped off.
Yeah.
5605. What happened?
Line in. Drop for a sec. I'm good again.
No, I can cut that out.
You should be good. Anyways, no continue, problem. Blake.
Cut this whole part out that I'm talking about right now.
You don't know it, but I actually work for the NSA.
The erosion of the Fourth Amendment.
We all do. It's just naturally. Every single person here is all trying to incriminate everybody else.
Exactly. We don't know it. We're also what do they call that? Compartmentalization. We're all so compartmentalized we don't know it, but we're all working for the government.
Wasn't there that like clip on the internet a few weeks back of all the people in the post office, and they all start like drawing on guns and stuff and like shooting each other, and then they all like hit the ground and they all pull out badges. They're all like, oh man, we're all from the government.
No, I haven't seen that. That sounds awesome though.
Oh gosh, it's so funny. They're like NSA, CIA, FBI, damn it.
Well, and that's when, as I review this case, the most illegal activities seems to be what the government is trying to do right now. I mean, to me, everything is blatantly unconstitutional, highly a top-down structure of going after, trying to do whatever it takes to because they want to put this guy in jail.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a witch hunt. It's they're gonna prosecute no matter what they have to do, I think.
Do you what do you guys think? Do you guys think they even have a case when after if it comes out that all their information was warrantless, that they start to start all this, and should it be thrown out? And that because to me, I see.
Well, I think
it
if
as
it turns out that it's warrantless, I mean, if they violated the Fourth Amendment, I don't think there's any contest whatsoever. Of course, it should be thrown out.
Well, it should be, but it's a national federal case, so I don't think that it will be. I think that it's so bad that they could completely find him scot-free, and they'd be like, he resisted arrest when we came to get him. He's going to prison.
Yeah, he went for the FBI guy's gun, so we had to shoot him in the head.
He stepped on his toe, and his toe is never going to be the same. He resisted arrest. He's got to go to prison.
Yeah, I think it's not looking good for him.
I don't know. I think the government's case is pretty weak, in my opinion.
I do too. And I
think it's set up to lose. And then because there's been this media blackout about this, you can get the lone wolf fired up. But
okay, all right.
There's a media blackout on this. It's highly unpublicized. And then once this, if he gets acquitted, it'll be a media uproar and, oh my God, this guy was a drug kingpin. He's let go. He's out of it. This is why we need more internet security.
Double jeopardy. He's going to go do it again and it's going to be bigger and we won't be able to convince him this time or convict him this time. Think of the children. We have to put him in jail for the good of the children.
We have to get rid of encryption. Control. Okay. You drop off there.
That killed it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that they're going to pull any punches here.
Yeah, I agree. So we have a few minutes left. So you wanted to talk a little bit about ChangeTip and what's going on there. We were actually, before the show, we were talking about microtransactions. And I mentioned it. Mentioned to
as
Chelsea.
A future that, topic.
As a future topic, but we can also allude to it a little bit here about the fact that you mentioned, you know, ChangeTip and how it's being funded by Pantera to a tune of about $3.5 million, and it's somewhat of a sham. You view it as a sham, Blake?
Well, no, I don't know that it's a sham. It's that there's a specific concern as far as people that are giving their data to ChangeTip through use being like, you got $3 million from Pantera Capital and your business model is not going to ROI that ever. Mm-hmm. Ever. Not even close. What is your plan for getting that money back to the investors that invested with you? And they say, well, you know, we'll just get lots of users and stuff. But I mean, even like scaling, there's no way. So then people are thinking, well, the data that you guys are getting is really, really interesting. Let's look at this. The data in the blockchain is pseudo anonymous as a result of the fact that there's lots of transactions and activity. It makes it so that there's a whole, you know, nest of activity, and it makes it hard to trace things. Well, if you are using ChangeTip, it's not on the blockchain. It's just all on their data server. So there's a lot less activity going on the Bitcoin network. It makes it a lot easier to track. And then what makes it even more easy to track is all the data that's on the ChangeTip servers links social media accounts to various different Bitcoin addresses. Then they can use various different analysis technologies to try to figure out who more and more and more Bitcoin users are. So basically, ChangeTip's business model could not be more toxic to Satoshi's dream of pseudo-anonymity. I don't know if they fully know this. I can't imagine that they don't, but I mean, like, they originally called their company ChangeCoin, and now it's ChangeTip. And ChangeCoin would be fine. It's an altcoin, and that's, you know, they can make an altcoin. But when you call it ChangeTip and say that it's Bitcoin when it's running on a substrate that's not on the Bitcoin blockchain, that really is ChangeCoin, not Bitcoin. And the down part about having that is that we don't even know what the monetary or economic policy is for ChangeCoin. We don't know what they're doing with their, you know, black box of information that's not on the blockchain. So it's something to look out for as far as the pseudo-anonymity thing. And then also, since they're not on the blockchain, that was Mt. Gox's trouble. They weren't not on the blockchain. So I want to try to avoid another giant Mt. Gox collapse before the 2016 block halving, because that's going to be a joyous event. And right now, ChangeTip apparently is in a cycle where they're going to respond to the community demands. The community is kind of wanting to know, what's your business model? How are you going to, you know, use the data? If you need to keep data, blah, 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 can you like delete it after a certain time, or can we come to some kind of agreement? And we don't know where that's going to lead, but hopefully it leads somewhere good that, you know, gets resolution for the community. But a professor at Cornell wrote an article basically about ChangeTip in its current state, and the article's headline was ChangeTip Must Die. So people feel pretty strongly.
Utilize Bitcoin and not be on the blockchain? That doesn't make sense to me.
Exactly. It means that it's not Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And it's a method, or the business model is to offer small, essentially conduct microtransactions as a way to gift or tip funds to individuals through utilizing social networking, so Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, where you can just deposit, let's say, 50 cents or buck and a half into somebody else's change tip account as a way to, you know, to gift them, correct? Isn't that essentially the business model, Blake? That's what they're trying to do?
Yeah, what they're trying to do is they're trying to drive adoption. They want to get like 10,000 new users a month. So they want people to go on Twitter and stuff and tip their friends and content creators and whoever, just tip people. And then the people that they tip, they want to keep tipping and doing all of that. But that is not – none of it's real until people cash out. And when people cash out, you can see how many people are adopting Bitcoin. But until they do that, that's not really Bitcoin adoption. It's change tip adoption. So it's not really mutual assent. It's almost kind of disingenuous to be like, look, it's Bitcoin. It's all Bitcoin, this and that. It's like, well, no, it's kind of like you're a service that accepts Bitcoin and then you can cash out in Bitcoin. But what's going on behind the scenes, I mean, like to say that it's Bitcoin has some very serious connotations relative to immutable blockchain ledger technology and not being able to fudge numbers and being able to look at different things. So it's not, I mean, it's not an easy conflation of those two things. So I think that change, I think that it's disingenuous, and I would really watch out for it.
Yeah, well, what I would assume a business model is if they're accepting Bitcoin and it's not going directly and the people hold their accounts, then if the price of Bitcoin grows, you know, then they would it wouldn't appreciate. Would it, you know, if it's based on a dollar amount, then that company would make the profit of it going down, and then they would lose if the Bitcoin drops. So,
well, if that was,
so it's not a direct transaction.
Yeah, if that had been the case, they'd be out of business right now because it went down so much. And as it goes up and down, like your account balance reflects your value in dollars, so the dollar goes up and down, but your Bitcoin balance doesn't go up and down and change it.
Well, I'm on their homepage, and only $90,000 have been tipped. So,
yeah,
it's not taken off. I don't know how new it is, but
well, those tips are also almost completely all exchanges, like friends tipping friends and like incestuous company tipping and stuff like that. So it's really kind of dishonest too to have those kinds of things up there, in my opinion.
I like the concept, but I don't, like you were saying, how it's not really Bitcoin.
Exactly. And I like
retailer.
The concept so much that's why I'm criticizing it, because the concept can be done better. There's a best practice here waiting to be uncovered. And I guess the biggest criticism of ChangeTip right now is that they haven't been responding to the community. They've been like blocking people and stuff for giving them suggestions on how to operate. So we'll see how that all plays out.
One thing we didn't talk about, Ross Ulbricht, is the charge of the money laundering. Can we talk about that for a second? I don't know if to me, I don't see how that's really money laundering that he's getting accused of, but that could end up being the nail in the coffin against him, I guess. But
yeah, I mean, it seems like one of those, if all, you know, resisting arrest or money laundering, we'll say, you know, Bitcoin is money or not, based on whatever use the government wants to say. Different departments of the government call Bitcoin, you know, different things based on convenience. So the money laundering could be a big problem for Ross, I think, with the way that they're loose and fast with their definitions regarding Bitcoin.
Yeah, and my favorite part is that what company was it again? HSBC with their little money laundering scheme, and no one went to prison for. And that's what they're
the Zeta cartel, like the most violent cartel like around.
Yeah, the real drug kingpins. And they're real dealing with the U.S. dollar and laundering the money for these drug cartels. It's pretty outrageous that no one went to jail, and that kind of just got shuffled under the rug. And then, you know, Ross Ulbricht here is supposedly this massive drug kingpin that's laundering all this millions of dollars in this cryptocurrency that's so damning America. But it's a shame.
And there was talk that potentially he was utilizing something called a Bitcoin Tumbler or a tool to launder money. But to me, I mean, he seems like a pretty smart guy. And there are traditional money laundering tools that would have worked much more efficiently if he was serious about it. So this, you know, to me, my gut tells me that this is another plot to convict him of a crime. I don't know. I think most people who understand how, you know, Bitcoin works and other, if they're really into this type of activity, they would choose something other than Bitcoin laundering to, you know, to hide their assets or hide their money trail.
Yeah, I mean, and this is where it's going to require our entire judicial system not screwing around with other stuff that doesn't matter to try to solve these kinds of problems, because on the internet, it's like intent and care. Like, did he care and or intend to launder those coins, or was that just a natural behavior that we're trying to call something else? Like, if your stuff is locked online and it's encrypted and the government comes in and it's like, we had strong enough technology to unlock that and we went and we looked. It's like, well, no, I cared that that was locked and I locked it and I meant to lock it. These are all different things, but it's like, what's possible versus what do people want? That's a huge thing that needs to be decided in our courts, and they're all, you know, basically like the, I don't know, just selling people down the river without proper evidence, and that's
not who wants to pay attention to that kind of thing? Come on.
But part of the Fourth Amendment hinges upon people's expectation of privacy.
Yeah.
And so that's why we have, for example, the exception for, you know, vehicles, or if you're having a conversation saying, I'm going to murder somebody in the middle of like a crowded room, you don't have the expectation of privacy. So, you know, anybody that could overhear you, you know, you don't need a warrant for that. However, for your personal home, you do. And then the same thing applies online. So if you have an expectation of privacy and you're doing your due diligence to put the locks on it and to put the passwords on it, that's one thing. But if you're leaving it wide open for anybody to grab, that's where they're seizing that opportunity and saying you didn't have an expectation of privacy because you didn't, you know, put the passwords on, you didn't put the encryption on, you didn't put the locks on. So that's like, you know, leaving your wallet in the middle, you know, of a crowded restaurant and walking away. You know, so we didn't need a warrant because you didn't, you know, do your work to make sure that you had an expectation of privacy.
Well, that's true. But there's also the argument that if we wanted to make into a realistic situation where people are talking and they're in public, so they have no expectation of privacy, at what point does it become absurd when the government has better and better and better and better listening technology that can angle into houses and various different private property that can listen to that too? So there's a gradient there in the public space, just as there's a gradient in the virtual space, which is, you know, well, I tried to lock this. I didn't use a good password, or I didn't use two-factor authentication, or I encrypted it, but I didn't hash. And you're right. Like, it should be a blanket statement. The government shouldn't, you know, go and collect a whole bunch of data and then keep making their technology better and better until it really invades privacy. But I think we should start having that conversation soon. This technology is getting pretty robust.
Question for you, Blake. As we get close to wrapping up, we'll talk about Bitcoin for a few more minutes and then end with a friend of Ulrich clip. So Bitcoin, since we last spoke, has gone down quite a bit in the last year. It's bounced off of what, at 175, and around 230 to 240 right now per Bitcoin. And I've seen, you know, quite a few explanations as to why that's happened. You know, getting some transactions being denominated in dollars rather than Bitcoin, so pulling funds out of the marketplace, but still, you know, upward trend of Bitcoin transactions taking place. Short selling, manipulation, that type of thing. But for the most part, from what I've seen and read, the common consensus within the community seems to be that, you know, Bitcoin may go down in the short term, but in the long term, it's as, you know, healthy of a platform as it's been in the last few years, and that the future looks pretty bright. What's been your take on kind of the decline and where it's going to go in the future?
Yeah, that's a good question. The way that Bitcoins are produced is very, very, very fast at first, and then very, very, very slowly at the end. And that time period spans between 2009 and 2140. And the way that they engender that situation is every 4 years, the amount of Bitcoins that are produced as the mining reward gets cut in half. So starting at 50 and then 25, and it gets cut in half and cut in half and cut in half. Right now, we're still pretty close to the beginning of Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is being made very quickly. It's very inflationary.
But we know the monetary policy is immutable and where it's going to go. So in the long term, it's a really, really, really good investment. And in the short term, mining got really competitive really fast. A lot of people are mining at a loss. A lot of people had to sell to pay off various different debts from their mining operations, things like that, which made the price sink because there was a lot more supply, and then the demand goes down a little bit. But there are people that actually think that Satoshi was smart enough to know that there's going to be these cycles between the 4 years, and that he wanted people to be able to reset their debt obligations by Bitcoin going down before reinvesting, getting their bootstraps pulled back up, and then making more money in the next block halving every 4 years, and then going through and being smarter and trying harder to continue to stay between the black and the red with their Bitcoin reserves. So it's a very interesting situation.
Yeah. Is that your opinion?
It would be a hard opinion to argue with, I think.
Okay.
And that's kind of combined. I mean, it plays a lesser role, but the stronger dollar has played a role, and I think a little bit of a role in the decline as well.
Yeah. Oh, and also, Ben Bernanke pushing off like any kind of an exchange opening in New York with his untenable Bitcoin license, and Mt. Gox, and all kinds of other stuff happened too that kind of changed the timeline as far as, how long the deflationary spirals will last, and then how big and severe the price pullbacks are after those spirals. But they will get smaller as far as the price pullback as you go through in the block halving isn't something from like 50 to 25, but lower. So is it a halving every time? Yes, but taking 25 bitcoins out of the 50 block reward in that first halving was a big event. So it's not instantly like, you can just look at it and see and expect what's going to happen, but it's more of a nuanced kind of feel that you get by going back and looking at what happened before and what's happening now. So it's kind of murky.
Well, what about even our government buying and, accumulating bitcoins and then flooding the market all of a sudden, trying to dump everything they, market manipulation that way? Because they were obviously buying Bitcoin during this setup.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that the government isn't very similar to everybody else's incentive to have it go down as far as possible before the next block halving in 2016, where it's going to go up really high, really fast. So incentives are really, really powerful. A lot of people want to hold their Bitcoin long term. It'll work out for them too. But if you don't want to hold your Bitcoin long term, some people are trying to make more money than just holding, and they're selling now, hoping for the price to go down even further, and then to repurchase, and then to ride up the 2016 block halving and the following deflationary spiral, wherein the price of Bitcoin goes up and the price of goods and services denominated in Bitcoin goes down.
Right. So there certainly could be quite a bit of short selling. It would surprise me if there isn't right now. And actually,
yep.
A good portion, I would think, especially I noticed when looking at Bitcoin charts, you saw heavy, heavy trading on the sharpest drops, which to me is pretty indicative of short selling. And there seems to be some, I would guess that there's been quite a bit of covering over the last week or two. Looking at it come up from 175 to 230, 240, and, it could be a little bit more of that, but the debt relief aspect, that's pretty interesting. I hadn't heard of that before. And if that's indeed, built into the platform, that's kind of at least for the people who are really producing, Bitcoin, that's it's a good way to get rid of some of that excess debt that you entail by, building out infrastructure and that type of thing to be able to mine it.
It's completely agree.
Yeah, it's really bizarre to go through the white paper and try to extrapolate everything that he knew was going to happen. Because I think the last time I was on the show, I said that Satoshi created something that interfaced with computers and Boolean logic and programming and circuitry and human culture and meat space and all that. Like the two systems interface with each other very, very, very well in ways that were very, very hard to predict. So I think that the intelligence of Satoshi might still not be fully understood.
Right. I'll roll this.
Can I ask a couple things real quick?
Okay.
One, I always hear that people are like, "Oh, we love Bitcoin and everything," but they always think something new is going to come and replace it. As more and more countries might end up leading towards a cryptocurrency of their own, as towards cashless societies, is there anything in the future that you foresee, or do you think that Bitcoin is strong enough to that the fundamentals are there to overcome anything like that?
I think that the technology that was brought forth by the white paper is great for harvesting out and trying to change things and make stuff. But I think that Bitcoin in and of itself, the way that it was made and when it was made, is like digital gold. And it will always be like digital gold. And there might be other digital silver or digital platinum and stuff like that. But I don't think that digital gold is going to go away.
Right on. And then I always heard about Bitcoin ATMs. Are those out yet, or are they going to? Anything about that as a business plan, or?
I used one in Texas, and I used one in Vegas. The one in Texas worked, but the CEO of the company that made it was right there, so that's not, like, you know, like, that's...
Because to me, that is the coolest thing. I mean, if you look at for the legalization of marijuana in Colorado, and how, since it's still illegal for the federal government, these companies are just stockpiling cash. They just have huge safes in their facilities, stockpiling all this cash, because they can't... Banks... you know, will not accept it because they're too afraid the federal government is going to come and confiscate the cash that they deposit.
Yep,
so
yep.
I'm thinking that Bitcoin ATM would be perfect in Colorado.
Yeah, my friend Noah Berger he lives in Colorado. He's friends, me and he and Sarah Blinko were hanging out at Money 2020 in Las Vegas, and he lives in Colorado and is just putting Bitcoin ATMs everywhere he can for that exact purpose. So that's really cool that you guys both kind of independently were like, that's yeah, a good use case for these machines.
I'm like, damn it, he beat me to it.
I'm sure there's room for more. All right, I'll roll this clip, and Matt, we can wrap it up.
Sounds good, brother.
On Tuesday, October 1st, our friend Ross was arrested.
And all we are left with is questions. More questions than answers.
We don't know what happened. We don't know all the facts. But we do know something.
We know the person.
We know that Ross is the friend who always shows up.
The friend you call when your car breaks down, or when you need help moving, or when you just need help.
Ross is the friend you trust because he gives you his honest opinion, even when it's difficult to hear.
Ross is the friend you can tell anything to because he always listens and never judges.
We know who Ross is. He's the son who makes time for his family and the brother who moves across the world to be close to his sister.
And the nephew who's always happy to see me.
We know who Ross is, and we know who Ross is not.
Ross is not a criminal mastermind, and Ross is not a killer.
We ask you to look beyond the headlines and see the man we love.
We ask you to reserve judgment until all the facts are in.
And finally, we ask for your support.
Please donate whatever you can to help us mount the best legal defense for our friend.
Add your voice to ours and help us bring Ross home.
Albrecht is
there we go. Brought it back.
What happened?
I had a little drop as well.
Yeah, my good friend is Lynn Albrecht, Ross's mother, and I was in New Hampshire talking to her. We were talking about being parents. I'm a parent as well. I have a son. And we were talking about raising your child, making sure that they know right from wrong, and when it's time to do something about a problem, to take responsibility. And he will go down in history, in my opinion. And I think that that is the kind of respect that he deserves. It's not kind of an angle that I get to talk about very often when I'm asked kind of my professional opinion about the case. But I think that Ross is a hero, and my heart is rendered for his mother.
Yeah, she's gone through a lot, and it's a sad situation. It is.
Thanks, Blake, for being here.
Thank you very much, Blake, for coming on tonight. Very much appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for including me. It was great to talk to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been Liberty Southwest podcast number 41. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Peace out.
Adios, mofo.